Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer Eleanor Herman. She's hosted shows on the History Channel and the National Geographic Channel, but we're talking about her new book, The Royal Art of Poison, Filthy Palaces, Fatal Cosmetics, Deadly Medicine, and Murder Most Foul. Eleanor, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here, Mark.
I love this book. It's really two books in one. There's a first section, which is, I don't know how to politely put this, but it's basically a history of filth.
which is pretty much just the history of history.
That's it. I mean, and that's the point you make. And also the use of toxic agents not intentionally in old Europe. And then the second section, the longer section, is 20 cases of strange, unusual deaths, sort of a historical CSI, which includes modern, contemporary for us, post-mortem diagnosis. How did you go down this rabbit hole? This is pretty interesting because you've done a lot of history shows, but how did you go down this particularly dank and dark one?
Good question. I wrote two books a few years ago, Sex with Kings and Sex with the Queen, and they look at royal European love affairs. And in research, I mean, I must have read hundreds of books for these two. And whenever anyone at court died, even if it was a long and lingering illness, people would say it must have been poison. This person had so many enemies at court and kind of thing. And I wondered, you know, was it really poison? Was it a natural illness? Did doctors have any idea what was going on with their patients? And I sort of shelved the idea to bring back at a later time and start looking into it to see if there's a book there. And I did that a couple of years ago, and boy, was there a book there. So first of all, it's the historical stories, really interesting stories. So you learn a lot about history,
right,
about these amazing individuals. And then I worked with people in the medical community, including some of the people, the researchers in Europe who dug up the bodies and performed tests on them, to find out what really killed them. So it was a lot of fun for me. I love forensic crime shows. I kind of wrote my own.
And there's a reason for this introductory section, because as you very clearly and disgustingly point out, people were not living great lives as far as cleanliness, as far as a lot of things. And I want to talk about some of that stuff right now. People were likely killing themselves anyway. That's your point. And so it's very difficult when a person dies, say back in the Elizabethan age or the Renaissance, they may have suspected poison, but they could have just as easily have killed themselves.
In far more cases, Mark, they killed themselves, or at least they contributed to their own death, which was ironic, right? Because these people were so afraid of being poisoned. They had these elaborate rituals, what they thought were unicorn horns being waved over the banquet table, which was supposed to magically detect if there was poison.
Yeah, that'll work. That'll work.
The kings and queens actually had their servants sit on the chamber pot, try on their underpants, kiss their knives and forks and spoons, you know, thereby depositing germs, but germs weren't discovered till the 1870s. So they had all of these elaborate rituals, which were really silly and really useless.
Not the least of which, if I can interrupt you, that, you know, some of these poisons take a while to take effect. So, you know, here's the first of all, I love the fact that I learned this from your book. Officers of the goblet and officers of the royal mouth. Looks good on the resume. And they're tasting the food, and then the royal personage eats it right away. And actually, that's not going to tell you much of anything.
No, it's not, because we now know that, let's say I gave you leek soup filled with arsenic, right? You probably, depending upon what was in your stomach to begin with, your height and weight and general health, you might not feel any symptoms for 2 hours.
Right.
And so in the movies, when we see the food tester, you know, take a little sip or a nibble and swish it around his mouth and then nod and everybody digs in, that would have been utterly useless. So all of their protocols were useless.
But there's a reason for this, too, and this is the other thing you bring up. There was a lot of poisoning going on. And in places like Italy, it seemed like it was, you know, it was a political – it was one of the things you could do politically. And there were people who were known poisoners.
Yes, there were, and there were actually poisoning factories poisoning universities, the Venice, you know. And it was a laboratory where they would experiment on animals and also on condemned criminals, and they would invent not only the toxins themselves but also the antidotes.
They hoped
that they would try those out on the volunteers, the criminals. So there was poisoning going on, and of the 20 individuals, five of them were, in fact, intentionally poisoned. The other 15 probably died of natural illness. But to get back to the point of they were poisoning themselves, they were loading themselves up with mercury, lead, and arsenic in the form of medications and cosmetics.
Well, let's pause on that for a minute, because I want to talk about the cosmetics thing, because that's fascinating. There was a passion for extremely white complexions. Mm-hmm. And so women would put on these cosmetics, which were just loaded with things like lead and other things that were dangerous. We now know today were incredibly dangerous.
Yes, and they wouldn't kill them right away. So that's why they didn't think they were dangerous. I mean, it might take years of wearing this stuff for you to to start getting like a bad digestion, and then you got really moody and you could snap at people. And nobody could put those two things together. Now, Queen Elizabeth, in the last decade of her life, and bear in mind, she wore this poison mask for 40 years. She had an attack of smallpox at 29 and left her skin pitted. So she put all of this poison on her skin to hide it. The last decade of her life or so, her mood changed. She was depressed. She was nasty. She'd sit in a darkened room for days at a time. And people at the time thought she was just old and cranky, because back then being in your 60s was like being in your 80s or 90s.
Right, right.
Now, but these days, researchers look at that and they say, all of those are symptoms of chronic heavy metal poisoning. And I'd love for them to break into Westminster Abbey and test her bones, but that won't be allowed because the ruling family of Britain doesn't want anyone to go poking around the DNA.
Oh, yeah, because there's a lot of other things you could find out.
There's a lot of stuff. Maybe they really shouldn't be the ruling family at this point. So we're probably never going to be able to do that in her case.
One of the most amazing pieces of makeup that I learned from your book is that people were using belladonna to make their eyes sparkle.
Yes. Yes. And that caused dizziness and heart murmurs and over time death.
But at least your eyes sparkled.
At least your eyes were sparkling on your deathbed.
Now, the other thing you mentioned was medicine. Now, if you thought the cosmetics were bad, I think you were really basically throwing in the towel if you called for a doctor at that time, because doctors, I mean, the state of medicine, especially in the 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, was just really pretty low. And let's talk about it. First of all, one of the things is all their medicine is based on the idea of the four humors.
Yeah.
And so they would try to sort of lessen whatever humors you have too much of if you were sick, which would mean they would bloodlet you.
Yes. And they would give you stuff to make you have projectile vomiting and violent diarrhea. You'd be totally dehydrated, right?
Oh, my God.
Your blood would be like half gone. And so whatever natural illness you had, if it was, an infection of some sort, bacteria, whatever, your body would no longer have the strength to fight it.
No.
And the irony is, the richer you were, the more expensive doctor you could bring in who could do all this stuff to you and kill you. Whereas if you were poor and you couldn't afford a doctor, you'd just go to bed with some hot chicken soup and you'd probably be fine.
Well, right, because I think you had to actively, avoid doctors in order to survive. I mean,
yes.
Cures for syphilis usually involved the ingestion of mercury.
Yes, and bear in mind that all medicine was based on trial and error. They had no chemistry tests for anything, so they try all this stuff, and if you died, that was the error. And they found out that mercury actually was at times helpful in treating, if not curing, syphilis. So the first line of syphilis are these disgusting, foul-smelling lesions all over the body. And by rubbing mercury on it, they would usually heal. Why? Because syphilis is caused by bacteria, and mercury is poisonous to bacteria. It would kill them. Now, over time, it could also very well kill the patient. The most dangerous form of treating syphilis was to put the patient in a kind of tent and then cook up the mercury so they would inhale it. And inhaled mercury goes right to the brain and can give you, like, it can explode your brain. It has symptoms of, like, giving you a massive stroke. So the inhaled tent kind of mercury treatment was the worst.
And they also used excrement a lot in their medicines, which is always great. Because I always want mouse poop when I'm taking a pill.
Right. Well, they would, like, put mouse poop in their eye and they would smear hot hog's turds onto an open wound. And, bacteria in human excrement, animal excrement. It's really dangerous. They were probably giving themselves massive infections, and then the doctors would come along and bleed them and kill them.
And then if that wasn't all bad enough, things that we now know that are sort of good for you, they said, no, you shouldn't do. You shouldn't get a lot of sunshine. You shouldn't get outside and get fresh air.
So bathing was considered to be so dangerous that people would consult their astrologers to see when they should take a full immersion bath. So should I take my bath 6 months from now when the moon is in Uranus, or should I take it 10 months from now, you know, when Venus is in something else? I think they did wash with a cloth and some water, maybe. But hygiene just was up to a person's individual preference. It wasn't required as it is these days with us.
Now, I just want to mention, I don't know if we want to talk about this or not, but one of the there are certain points when I'm reading your book that I just literally lost it. I just, like, started laughing out loud. That it was, like, so insane. But there was actually a year of the royal fistula. It's like, I have to admit, I read many books a week, and that's the first time I've ever come across that.
Right, that was Louis the 14th, King of France, and in the 1680s he had an anal fistula, which is a kind of opening there that can be very, very painful. And it's often caused by poor hygiene, that this thing sort of opens up, it's like a wound. And apparently Louis the 14th only took two full baths in his life. And his mistresses doused themselves with perfume, not to hide their own body odor, but to try to mask the king's. So he had this thing, and they performed an operation, and they actually fixed it, without anesthesia. It must have been horrifying. And the doctor leading up to the operation got volunteers. These were real volunteers, people who wanted to help the king. Some of them died on the operating table. They finally figured out what he was doing, and he healed the king, and at that court, the king was just so popular. He was the sun king. Everything revolved around him, that the men started wearing these bandages over their breeches, pretending that they had fistulas too, so they called it the year of the fistula.
It was all the rage.
It was all the rage to pretend that you had a fistula.
Oh, my God. There's a fashion trend we won't be returning to anytime soon.
Hopefully not, yes.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer Eleanor Herman. She has hosted shows on the History Channel and the National Geographic Channel and others, but we're talking about a new book, which is really a fascinating read, alarming too. The Royal Art of Poison, Filthy Palaces, Fatal Cosmetics, Deadly Medicine, and Murder Most Foul. Wow, it doesn't get darker than that, Eleanor. That's like the darkest it can ever get. I want to talk about the state of the Royal Palace too, because I think a lot of people, especially if you, what you know about history, you've seen through films, you have this image of what a royal palace would be like, say, back in the 1500s, 1600s. And as you describe the palaces, that they were just sort of, incredibly filthy, dominions of dung, I think is how you put them. It was amazing because people just, especially if you were one of the people who were waiting on the royal family, you didn't take a break to go to the bathroom. You just sort of turned around and did it in the palace.
Yes, many of us have walked through the corridors of Versailles Palace and Windsor Castle, all these beautiful places, and we think, wow, I wish I could have lived back then in such a beautiful place. But what you don't get on your modern-day tour is the smell of the palace.
Wow.
And they had no running water, no flush toilets or anything, so they had chamber pots in every room, which even if you put a lid on it, it must have smelled pretty bad. You have people who didn't wash, so they smelled. And a lot of the courtiers, they wouldn't even go in search of a chamber pot. They would just drop their britches and do their business, you know, number one and two, wherever. So the stairways, the hearths, the corners of the rooms, the halls. There are reports from the 17th century about, you know, how filthy it is, how much human excrement is in the hallways. And the royal courts, most of them would, every week or two, ride to another palace. And it wasn't for a change of scenery or fresh air. It was so that the minute they left, hundreds of servants would emerge with buckets full of hot, soapy water and scrub brushes. And they'd scrub all the human excrement off of the palace walls and floors and clean it up so the court could come back and do that all over again.
Plus, they all kept dogs. They all had dogs and other animals that were
just... They had dogs and were doing their business. They had dogs in the kitchens to turn the meat spit. They had a little, like a little terrier that was hyperactive. They had cats to chase the rats. They had, all palaces had horses, of course, and goats and cows and chickens. And so there was dung and fleas everywhere. And the illnesses that started off in animals like anthrax could easily jump to the human population.
Now, this brings us to these cases of death that were suspected at the time as possibly being poisoning. And it's an interesting array of people. There are kings, queens, emperors. There's astronomers, czars, mistresses.
Artist
Caravaggio, fascinating case. Let's talk about Caravaggio and why he would be suspected of being poisoned.
Well, he had a lot of enemies.
He sort of led a rather violent life.
He did, and he was one of the world's most talented artists ever. He completely changed religious art around the year 1600. And he was also brutally violent and moody and nasty, and he was always getting in duels. He killed people, and because of his talent, the cardinals would get him pardoned. But there was a lot of vendettas against him. The families of these people he had harmed were trying to kill him. And you know, he did die mysteriously. He was chasing a ship that had taken off without him with his paintings on it, and he died, and nobody really knew had he been poisoned or was it just a natural illness. And they found recently in Italy bones that they thought were probably his, and they looked at the bones and realized that there were off the charts levels of lead and mercury, which is what the paints of the time were made of.
That's right.
And Caravaggio, to get a really fine tip on a little brush, you would suck on it.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that poison over the years would have been going into his system. And this kind of stuff ends up in the brain over time and makes you crazy and makes you moody and violent. So it could be a lot of the cause of the tempestuous artists of the Renaissance was due to their toxic paints making them crazy.
And he was also a person that if anybody was going to be poisoned who had people out after him, Caravaggio was a great example. Ivan the Terrible, who's also in your book, is a person that and his mother and his first wife, talk about a person that deserved to be poisoned. It would be Ivan the Terrible.
Yes.
Because he was terrible.
He was terrible. Well, he was sadistic. He was just off the
horrible.
Crazy. Yes, and killed, I don't know, tens of thousands of innocent people and tortured them and liked to watch this kind of thing. But when they looked at his bones, they did find some mercury. But when it's in the bones, you see it's chronic. It takes time to show up
Got
in
it.
The bones.
Yeah.
It takes weeks, probably months or years. And so it's probably just medicinal. And there's some belief that he may have had syphilis and was being treated for it. With mercury. Now, his wife and his mother had both died young, And that drove him even more crazy because he felt that they had been poisoned. And looking at their remains, there was extra mercury and lead in them. Not a whole lot, though. So I think that was probably cosmetic. That was the white faces Jeez. That all the women at the Russian court wanted.
It's amazing reading your accounts because there are several things that happened. First of all, there are contemporary to these people's time period people who witnessed these personages dying. And I have to say, they're all pretty gruesome. I mean, these people just didn't keel over and die. It often took them hours, sometimes days, in excruciating pain to pass on. But then they would do an autopsy of a sort at that time. Talk to me about that. What were they looking for?
They were looking for anything unusual, including a natural illness. Was there a big tumor?
So they recognized tumors. They knew what a tumor was.
They would recognize a big growth, for instance.
Okay.
And they looked for discoloration. They didn't necessarily know what that meant, but if the liver was like really too dark or too light or what, if they looked for bleeding in the stomach, holes, ruptures in the lining of the stomach, which might indicate a caustic poison. And the bottom line was they really didn't know much, but they kept these really detailed reports of the autopsies so that today's doctors can read them and say, wow, I think I know what happened to this person. Well, that was really helpful in my research.
Now, getting back to when people are doing sort of autopsies now of these people, what are they working with? Are they just working with descriptions, or are they actually working with physical human remains?
In many cases, there are remains. Very few in France, because during the French Revolution, the peasants cracked open just about every tomb they could find and rifled through it and tossed the bones into the wind. So when they have the remains, they can do all kinds of things with the bones to find out, you know, the diet, the health, the illnesses. How often was this guy on a horse? Was this a woman who was kneeling all the time at an altar and her knee bones looked strained? Yeah, they can tell you all kinds of things just from the skeleton. In rare cases, they have the organs too, like the one guy who was
a
mummy, Con Grande della Scala, and they found that he had indeed been poisoned with digitalis because they had his liver and his esophagus and his rectum, and it was just filled with this poison. So clearly he had been poisoned. Now, in cases where they don't have a body, they often have locks of hair.
And that can be useful for registering things like lead, can it? Or
yes, any kind of a chronic, slow, low-dose poison would show up in the hair, as well as DNA, if they're lucky. And in cases where there's absolutely no physical remains at all, you do have the autopsies and the descriptions of the symptoms leading up to death. And that can certainly point you in the right direction.
These stories, and again, people need to read this because every single chapter in that part of the book is like a whole book in and of itself, because you go through the history of the person, essentially why they deserve to be poisoned. And and then these gruesome descriptions of their death, and then, you know, modern findings. One of the ones I found fascinating was Napoleon Bonaparte. Because I had actually, years ago, had interviewed somebody who sort of suggested that he died on St. Helena because of the wallpaper. And you talk about that in the book. Talk to me about Napoleon's death.
Well, Napoleon was a very intelligent man in many ways. And contrary to most people of his time, he hated doctors. I think that's what kept him so healthy up until the end. Right? The minute he'd meet a doctor, he'd look him up and down, cross his arms, and say, "Monsieur, how many people have you killed in your practice?" And when he finally got really ill on St. Helena, there were doctors there, and they said, "You know, please let us give you some medicine." And he said, "Monsieur, I do not wish to have two illnesses, the one I already have and the one that you will give me." So that was one thing he did smart. And the second thing was he was just a very clean person. He carted a lead bathtub around with him on campaign every day, and he scrubbed in hot water with soap. So he became ill on St. Helena, and there was some debate as to whether it was the wallpaper. Let me go back a minute. In the 1960s, a Swedish dentist who was a Napoleon buff obtained locks of his hair, and he had looked at all of Napoleon's symptoms during his final illness on St. Helena, which lasted actually a couple of years of a slow and painful decline.
Oh, yeah.
He lost weight, he was vomiting, all of this stuff. And he said, you know, most of these symptoms are symptoms of chronic arsenic poisoning. So he obtained locks of Napoleon's hair, because everybody wanted one, you know, so whenever his barber would cut his hair, he'd mail off locks to people. And there was 100 times the normal amount of arsenic in his hair. So he thought that he had been poisoned. Other people, looking at the wallpaper in his house on St. Helena, realized it was arsenic green wallpaper.
Right.
It was very popular for over 100 years. It was a beautiful, bright shade of green, and it was made of, like, pure arsenic. So maybe he had been inhaling the arsenic, and that's how...
The wallpaper did it.
The wallpaper did it, right? When they did his autopsy, one of the most important autopsies in the history of the world, if it came out that he had indeed been intentionally poisoned, there would have been revolutions across Europe. All those kings sat on very shaky thrones, and they were holding their breath during the autopsy. But they found this enormous cancerous growth in his stomach.
And that was hereditary, too. Wasn't it in his family?
Yes, his father had died at the age of 38 of the same exact thing, and Napoleon was 52.
Eleanor, we got to stop there. We're out of time.
Oh,
that's too bad. But, you know, this is the kind of book you could talk about for years. Like I said, every chapter is a whole story in and of itself. My guest tonight is writer Eleanor Herman. She's hosted shows on the History Channel, National Geographic Channel, and others. But we've talked about her new book, and it's really it's like a great read. It's fun and disturbing at the same time. Which is really a unique sort of sensation to experience. The Royal Art of Poison, Filthy Palaces, Fatal Cosmetics, Deadly Medicine, and Murder Most Foul. Eleanor, it's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.